I have to say, worship team, that I wondered what it'd be like to sing the exact same songs, you know, in two services and on a Sunday morning. And I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying singing through them twice. That last one is vaguely familiar, but beautiful song. Great, great words. Forever I am changed by your love. I mean, that just kind of defines our daily living, our sanctification process, that we're forever constantly changed. Would you turn, please, to 1 Samuel, the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 1. I'm going to be reading through it in sections this morning as we go along. But before I get into that text, I just want to show a short video.
The ancient Greeks were among the first to pay tribute to Mom, sort of. Their spring festival honored Rhea, the mother of all Greek gods. That holiday didn't pan out. In medieval Britain, servants were given the fourth Sunday of Lent to travel home and spend the day with their moms. This custom was called Mothering Sunday. But the modern era Mother's Day was created by Anna Marie Jarvis. Anna admired her mother, who attended to the wounded during America's Civil War and later became a community activist. When young Anna was 12, it is believed she heard her mother pray that one day there might be a Memorial Day for mothers, for all the good that they do. Young Anna never forgot the prayer, and when her mom died in May of 1905, the plan for a holiday was born. On the second anniversary of her mom's death, Anna held a church memorial dedicated to her mother's good deeds. In May of 1908, Anna held another memorial and handed out white carnations, her mom's favorite flower. She contacted Philadelphia philanthropist John Wanamaker, who joined a Mother's Day committee in hopes of honoring all mothers all across the nation. In 1910, West Virginia became the first state to observe the second Sunday in May as Mother's Day. After a fierce letter-writing campaign, Anna got Congress to federally recognize the holiday. And in 1914, President Wilson signed a bill that officially made the second Sunday in May Mother's Day. The holiday was meant to be spent in church. Afterwards, sons and daughters would write loving letters to their mothers. Carnations were worn that day. Pink or red honored living mothers, and white honored moms who had passed. With each year, more and more Mother's Day carnations were sold. And by 1920, greeting card companies got into the Mother's Day biz. Anna was enraged by what she considered a lazy excuse for letters that should be handwritten. By 1924, the holiday creator was so appalled with the commercialization of Mother's Day that she petitioned to abolish it. In 1930, Anna was arrested for disturbing the peace at a Mother's Day carnation sale. Sadly, Anna spent the rest of her life and family inheritance fighting the holiday. She died in 1948, leaving no children to remember her. Since then, Mother's Day has become one of the most profitable holidays for florists and the phone company's highest volume day of the year. This probably wouldn't have pleased Anna, but deep down, she would have to be satisfied that on her Mother's Day, millions of moms around the world receive extra attention and well-deserved hugs.
So kids, if you got your mom a Mother's Day card, better tear it up and write a note. I think that's what they're saying there. Anna Jarvis would be happy if you did. Moms, do you have any idea how much money we spend on you and Americans? I won't take guesses, but here's the number. Over $21 billion in the United States. That is a lot of money. So if the money spent is any indication of how much we love you, we love you a lot, very much. Seriously, though, we do. Father's Day did not become a national holiday until 1972, signed into law by President Nixon. Any guess as to how much we spent on Father's Day? Not as much, but still a lot. $13 billion. Now, my point here is not to decry the commercialization of Mother's Day or to goad you into spending a lot of money. However, if flowers or a greeting card or a dinner out or whatever it is, if your mom feels honored by that, it doesn't matter what you think. Does your mom feel honored by that? Then for sure, do it. Absolutely do it. What moms, you can do, you can say, hey guys, hey kids, where's my slice of that $21 billion? I want a little Mother's Day chunk. This is obviously a day set aside to honor and remember your mothers. And it's in that spirit that we're going to read and work our way through the book of 1 Samuel, looking at Hannah's story. Great story. We believe, don't we, that every word on every page is inspired in this book. And because that is true, we can take a story that's 3,000 years old and we can find amazing application to our life today. So let me start with the first principle and then start reading through chapter 1. She was not jealous or contentious. I'm going to pick up at chapter 1, verse 1. There was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim of the hill country of Ephraim whose name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, son of Elihu, son of Tohu, son of Zuph, an Ephrathite. He had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other, Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. Now this man used to go up year by year from his city to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts at Shiloh, where the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests of the Lord. On the day when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah, he gave a double portion because he loved her, though the Lord had closed her womb. And her rival used to provoke her grievously to irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. So it went on year by year. As often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she used to provoke her. Therefore, Hannah wept and would not eat. And Elkanah, her husband, said to her, "Hannah, why do you weep? And why do you not eat? And why is your heart sad? Am I not more to you than 10 sons?" We're told in the story that Hannah was obviously distressed by this constant, continual abuse that she received from her rival. It was the second wife of her husband. That's the problem right there, isn't it? That never goes well in Scripture. But despite that abuse, there's no evidence that she was ever jealous, ever contentious toward Peninnah. She desperately wanted a son, and she could have easily lashed out in anger because of that abuse, but she did not. Now compare her example to that of some other women who were in similar circumstances. We go back and we think about Sarah. She was not able to have a child with Abraham. So what did she do? She gave her maidservant Hagar to Abraham so they could have a son together. And whose idea was that? Sarah's idea. That's important to remember because when Hagar became pregnant, Sarah said this to Abraham, "You are responsible for the wrong I am suffering." Laid all the blame on him, even though it was her idea. Sarah was so jealous, so mean to Hagar, that Hagar ran away into the desert and was willing to die in the desert rather than face that continual abuse. And had it not been for a word from the Lord to encourage her to return back to Abraham and Sarah, she may well have died in the wilderness. Later, when Sarah's son Isaac was born, she was so angry that she said this to Abraham, "Get rid of that slave woman and her son." So Sarah demonstrated a tremendous amount of jealousy, a great deal of contentiousness toward what she perceived was her direct competition. But then it continued, didn't it? We see in Scripture that the sins of the fathers are passed down in the third and fourth generation. Same is true with the mothers, because the wife of Sarah's grandson, Jacob, did the exact same thing. Remember, Jacob married both Rachel and Leah. There we go, it's another problem. But just like Peninnah in 1 Samuel, Leah, the older sister, began to bear sons to Jacob. And Rachel was so insanely jealous and angry that she said this to Jacob, "Give me children or I'll die." Do you remember what happened next? Rachel's solution to her infertility was exactly like that of Sarah's. Rachel gave her servant to Jacob to bear sons through her. But at least as far as we're told, she was not just jealous, she turned it actually into a contest. Let me read from Genesis 30. "Then Rachel said, 'God has judged me and has also heard my voice and given me a son.' Therefore she called his name Dan. Rachel's servant Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. Then Rachel's son said, 'With mighty wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister and have prevailed.' So she called him Naphtali." So here's the way it looked. You know, Leah had four sons, so Rachel's like, "I got to get into this." So two sons through Bilhah, and then Leah said, "Hey, that maidservant thing works well." So two sons through her maidservant. Lord opened Leah's womb, two more sons, and then Rachel, of course, finally had two sons. But the final score is 8-4. Rachel lost that battle. Back and forth they went, each of them battling for ultimate supremacy. And what was the avenue that they're using to battle with? Their wombs. They were battling with their wounds and keeping score. There was a running score all along this battle. Now, I understand men can be competitive, right? That's kind of the nature of men. If you think about competitiveness, normally you would think about men. But I'm told, and I've seen it myself at times, that women are also competitive toward one another, but a little bit differently. For example, ladies, have you ever, don't raise your hand, have you ever been jealous of another woman? Ouch. Yeah, no doubt you have. And again, women compete differently than men. Like Sarah, Rachel, and Leah, women tend to compete in the arena of the home. Men, we compete more or less in the marketplace. Now, these are generalities. Men compete more in the marketplace. Women tend to compete more in the arena of home. And what do? Excuse me. They compare their children, don't they? They look at other children and they say, oh my goodness, you know, my kids were misbehaving in church today, but did you see the Browns kids? Oh man, they're good kids. I don't know what they're doing. You compare your kids. You compare how your kids are doing at church. You compare how they're doing in school. You compare, and sometimes the finances get tight, and you see the other family, and they've got, you know, all these nice bicycles and toys and Legos and things that you just can't afford all that stuff. And so you compare, and you're jealous because there's all that. So what are you doing? You're keeping score, moms. You're keeping a running tally. Now, you may not be in a battle with someone like Leah or Rachel, but any mom can keep score with other moms, and all moms do it, and that is just an example of jealousy. Now, having said that, I'm very well aware that mixed in there is great love, tremendous nurturing. You know, it's like a dad who gets imbalanced. A dad goes out and tries to earn income and support his family, but we know how quickly that can get imbalanced, right? They spend too much time at work. They're too concerned about money. They become obsessed with it. So a good thing becomes a sinful thing. So it can be with moms. This great desire to love and nurture and care for your kids can easily get imbalanced and turn into jealousy and sinful things. But here's the great thing about this story. We don't see any evidence of jealousy or contention in Hannah's character, even though she was mercilessly assaulted by Peninnah. So I firmly believe Hannah is a role model for 21st century mothers and also obviously for fathers as well. And one reason for her ability to endure was no doubt related to our second principle, is that she trusted the perfect justice of God. I'm going to jump ahead in the story a little bit. I'm going to read all the way through chapter 1, but if you jump to chapter 2, you see, and of course we know the rest of the story, that she does indeed have a son. And in chapter 2, she is praying this celebratory prayer to the Lord. And I want to show you what she said at verse 3. She said, "Talk no more so very proudly, let not arrogance come from your mouth. For the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed." And when I see that, you know what I think of? I think she was talking about Peninnah. Talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth. That has to have been directed at Peninnah. I'm pretty sure of that. Even though Hannah would not return the abuse to Peninnah or even complain to her husband, there's no example of her even complaining to him, she knew full well God saw what was going on. God saw every instance of abuse. God saw every mean, cursing word against her, and he would right the wrong regardless of what she did. She trusted the perfect justice of God. Now, moms, I don't know how this would work with your kids when your kids disobey and you say, well, you know what, you're in the hands of God. I'm going to trust the perfect justice of God to deal with your disobedience. You don't do that. Why? Because it's your responsibility to deal with their daily disobedience. Now, God sees all those things, obviously, but he has entrusted you, he's entrusted dads to responsibly discipline them, to train them in godly wisdom and character. But when it comes to another adult who is abusing you, perhaps, or like Hannah dealt with, who's provoking you into anger, and there's a lot of provocation goes on, right? Maybe it's in the workplace, maybe it's other places. Provoking you into anger, you need to trust the perfect justice of God. However, having said that, it doesn't mean that relationship problems should be ignored. And I find that's more often the problem. It was when we have a relational difficulty with somebody, what's our gut level reaction? What's our default reaction? Hit the road, right? Turn the other way. I don't want to deal with that. I don't know what's going to come out of that person. That scares me. I already have a conflict. If I try to talk to them, the conflict's just going to get bigger. It's not going to get worse. So we run away. That is typically our default setting. So we need to, and this is so much all tied up in the Christian life, all the time, to lovingly talk to somebody, confront them, deal with them as much as possible. However, there are times when you've tried to do that and people refuse to reconcile with you. They'll have nothing to do with you. It's at that point then you have to trust the perfect justice of God, regardless of what is happening. Thirdly, she prayed according to the sovereignty of God. Let me pick up at verse 9 and keep reading there. After they'd eaten and drunk in Shiloh, Hannah rose. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat beside the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. She was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. And she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant and remember me and not forget your servant, but will give to your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall touch his head. As she continued praying before the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was speaking in her heart, only her lips moved and her voice was not heard. Therefore, Eli took her to be a drunken woman. And Eli said to her, How long will you go on being drunk? Put your wine away from you. But Hannah answered, No, my Lord, I am a woman troubled in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have been pouring out my soul before the Lord. Do not regard your servant as a worthless woman. For all along I have been speaking out of my great anxiety and vexation. Then Eli answered, Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant your petition that you have made to him. And she said, Let your servant find favor in your eyes. Then the woman went away and ate, and her face was no longer sad. Again, we see Hannah's heart here. She wanted a child, and specifically she wanted a what? A son. Because in that culture, you could easily be disgraced unless you could bring baby, not just baby girls, but baby boys into the world. Remember, we go back to that struggle, that competition between Rachel and her sister Leah to have children by Jacob. When Rachel's maidservant bore Jacob a son, Rachel named him Dan, and the meaning there means God has vindicated me, right? You see that struggle, and she's naming her kids that way. The next son born, she named Naphtali, which means my struggle. Imagine naming, and I know sometimes it's hard to come up with names for your kids, right? But to name them stuff like that, I mean, that's like saying in your face, right? I mean, it's so rude. It's so kind of out there. I have won. I beat my sister. Horrible. Rachel wanted a son, in large part, I think, to take away her personal shame. She was caught up in that cultural shame. She did it because her personal worth was intimately tied to her ability to bear sons. And that's always a problem, isn't it? When your personal worth is tied to something, one, you have no control over it, and two, it's not really necessarily a godly thing to worry about. And she was just torn up about it. Now, by comparison, Hannah wanted a son, but we see no evidence of her having a similar struggle. In fact, it seems to be that she wanted a son because of this natural God-given desire that moms have. She prayed fervently for her desire to come true, but at the same time, she was not demanding of God. You see nothing of that happening here. When she prayed according to the sovereignty of God. She had absolutely no guarantee that God was going to answer her prayer. After all, she surely knew, and there were countless women in Israel at that time who also were not able to bear children. So she was just one of dozens and hundreds and perhaps thousands of people. She asked God for a son, but she did not demand that God answer her prayer, which is very similar to what I mentioned a few weeks ago, that you ask God, but do not demand. You ask, you beg, you plead, you ask again and again and again. God wants us to come to him, to continually come in prayer and pour out our hearts to him, but you never demand. And that's what I see Hannah doing here. And it's very disturbing to me. I see many many streams within Christianity where demanding is the norm. And I'll give you a couple examples. One would be word of faith. And the other would be prosperity theology, prosperity churches. Those churches, those streams within Christianity, when you strip away the Christian shell, you know what you're left with? paganism and witchcraft. Paganism and witchcraft. Because what they're doing is they say to themselves, if I just say the right kind of words, if I give just enough money, God has to answer my prayers. He will. It's guaranteed. He is sworn to do so. And all what you're doing, it's a form of incantation. It's kind of magical spells that they're doing. So it's just straight up paganism. After finally finishing reading through the book of Jeremiah this past week, I decided, well, what am I going to read next? And I thought, well, what is a natural follow-up to Jeremiah would be Lamentations. Now, when's the last time you said, man, I can't wait to read Lamentations. I want to read about Jeremiah crying and crying and crying, because that's what the whole book is about. But in the midst of that, well, let me first of all read to you a little bit of chapter 3, and we see, which really represents the book of Lamentations. He writes, I am the man who has seen affliction under the rod of his wrath. He has driven and brought me into darkness without any light. Surely against me he turns his hand again and again the whole day long. He has made my flesh and my skin waste away. He has broken my bones. Now let me stop there and ask, who is the he here? This is the Lord. He's saying he has done this. The Lord has done this. God has done these things to me. He has walled me about so that I cannot escape. He has made my chains heavy. Though I call and cry for help, he shuts out my prayer. Let me ask you this question. Was Jeremiah right to assign blame to God for these things? Absolutely. Absolutely. God had done these things. Remember, this followed on the heels of hundreds and hundreds of years of horrible disobedience and idolatry from first Israel, then Judah. And what Jeremiah's caught up in here is Judah being taken off into captivity, the temple destroyed. That was it. Solomon's temple was no more. And God had done all those things. God had initiated all those things. So he was right to say what he said. However, in the midst of that great suffering, in the midst of nothing but weeping and lamentation, 12 verses more of it in this chapter alone, here is what he said next. But this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I will hope in him. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the soul who seeks him. It is good that one should wait for the salvation of the Lord. Now, what's the key? What's the key to his turnaround, to turn from lamenting into hope? What is the difference? Verse 21, but this I call to mind. Do you see it? This I call to mind. There he was lamenting. It was as bad as it could possibly get. But he called these truths to mind. Truths that he already knew, but he needed to remember them. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. Great is thy faithfulness. And I'm telling you, that's exactly what you and I need to do. We need to call these things to mind. Now, how do you do that? All kinds of ways. First of all, you memorize the Word of God. That's foundational. I don't care if you do 5 verses a year, some favorite verses. Maybe you're going to take some of this text and memorize it. You memorize those words so you can call upon them, call them to mind anytime. You regularly dig into His Word. You've got to consider it as your food, because otherwise you're not calling that stuff to mind. That's why you're so caught up in the lamentations and the sorrows. They're real. I'm not downplaying the suffering in your life. But you've got to call those things to mind. A fellow pastor in Wisconsin told me this story years ago. There was a woman that was not able to have kids. And this, obviously, we understand Mother's Day especially can kind of bring those painful things out. But unfortunately, this woman had been dealing with this for years. And instead of turning to the Lord and calling to mind the good things of the Lord, she allowed great bitterness to develop in her heart. And what she would do is she would usually almost sit in the very front row. And any time the pastor brought up a topic of children, and this is his words, he recounted this to me, she had blonde hair, kind of medium-length blonde hair. Anytime the topic of children came up, she would be like, no, no, you can't talk about it. No, that's too painful. I won't hear. There she was, the whole congregation saying, no, don't talk about it. I can't handle this. But this I call to mind. She I would say, without knowing her, refused to call to mind the fact that the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. You must call these things to mind. And if you know someone who has struggled with infertility, as I said, Mother's Day tends to draw these things out and bring these things to the surface. I encourage you, tell her about Hannah. Don't just tell her, you know, about Hannah. Oh, look, everything worked out so good for Hannah. Surely things are going to work out for you. That's not the story of Hannah. The story of Hannah is she prayed having no idea how it was going to work out. That's the story of Hannah. Let me encourage you as well, moms, that you are not defined by your wombs. You're not defined by your wombs. Whether you have no kids, one kid, 12 kids, it doesn't matter. You're not defined by your wombs. That is not the source of your worth. Fourthly, she dedicated her children to the Lord. Picking up at verse 19 now. They arose early in the morning and worshiped before the Lord. Then they went back to their house at Ramah. And Elkanah knew Hannah his wife, and the Lord remembered her. I always love that when the Lord answers a prayer, remember. And in due time, Hannah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Samuel, for she said, I've asked for him from the Lord. So that's a much better name than in your face, right? I've asked him for him from the Lord. The man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice and to pay his vow. But Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband, as soon as the child is weaned, I will bring him, so that he may appear in the presence of the Lord and dwell there forever. Elkanah, her husband, said to her, do what seems best to you. Wait until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord establish his word. So the woman, in other words, you know, you better keep your promise. So the woman remained and nursed her son until she weaned him. And when she had weaned him, she took him up with her, along with a three-year-old bull, an ephah of flour, and a skin of wine, and she brought him to the house of the Lord at Shiloh. And the child was young. Then they slaughtered the bull, and they brought the child to Eli, and she said, oh, my Lord, as you live, my Lord, I am the woman who was standing here in your presence praying to the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition that I made to him. Therefore, I have lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is lent to the Lord, and he worshipped there. Now, this time, who's the he? And he worshipped there. Who's the he? It's Eli. It's Eli. There he was. He's like, oh, you worthless drunk woman. And now he sees what the Lord has done. And he worshipped as a result. Now, I think when we think of Hannah, this is what she's probably best known for. Dedicating her son Samuel. She fulfilled her promise to dedicate him to the Lord. Now, this is similar to what we do with child dedications. And this morning, we get to dedicate to the Lord little Hadley here in a little bit. So we're looking forward to that. Now, it's similar to, and we base it on, but it's different, isn't it? It's different because I don't think Hadley is going to be like, you know, given to the church. Like I don't think Beth wants me to raise Hadley. You know, put and she could bring a little robe to him once a year. You know, to her once a year. I don't think that's going to work. But it is an important symbol. It is an important ceremony that we work through. That we say yes. They're going to stand up here and say yes. I will follow the Lord, and I will raise my daughter, I will raise my son in the fear and admonition of the Lord. It's important, but it's a little different, isn't it? Remember her promise in verse 11, if you give me a son, I will give him back to the Lord. See, remember, there's no guarantee that she's going to have more children. Samuel was all she had in all the world, but still she fulfilled that vow and literally gave him to Eli. It was like Eli adopted Samuel at that point. So my question is, in what ways do we dedicate our children to the Lord? And again, what we practice is similar to what Hannah did, but different. And the parents say, we dedicate ourselves, we're dedicating our child to the Lord, but we're also dedicating ourselves to raise him or her in the fear of the Lord. So if you've done that, what did you mean by that? Maybe it was 20, 30 years ago. Maybe it was last year. What did you mean by that? When you said, I will do this, we will do this, did you mean that you trusted God to do whatever he wishes with that son or daughter? Is that what you meant? Did you mean when you made that dedication that it's okay if God whisks them off to the mission field somewhere and you only see them maybe every 1 or 2 years? Is that what you meant? When you made that commitment, were you saying that it's okay, you're going to make it if God allows sorrow and pain in your children's lives? And I'm told, because I'm not there yet, my kids are at the process where they're leaving the nest, and that's painful enough for me. I started getting choked up in the first service just thinking about it, but when Ryan went off to get an apartment in La Crosse, now 2 years ago, I got teary-eyed the morning he left, and then I got him getting teary-eyed, and I'm thinking, he's going to be home every weekend, pretty much. What's the deal, Maurer? See, it's a different phase, isn't it? It's the beginning of the empty nest. Those are hard transitions. But is that what you're saying? And I realize it doesn't matter how old your child is. If they're in pain, you feel it, right? Is that what you meant when you committed your son or daughter to the Lord? Hannah's commitment to her son and to the Lord was to wean and release him. Now we get our kids a little bit longer, right? She had maybe about a year with them. So instead of 1 or 2 years, we have approximately 18 years, and then we release them. Well, what's that fishing term? Catch and release. What we do as parents, we raise and release. We raise and release. That's what God has called you to do. Raise and release them into the hand of God. But the thing is, do you trust that hand? Or would you rather pull them back? Pull them back. Or as the new term is, hover. Helicopter parents, right? How are they doing? I got to check on you. I got to get into every detail of your life. Why? Because I haven't really let you go. I don't quite trust God yet. Some adult children, even more difficult than maybe going off the mission field, is some adult children stray from the Lord. I think that would be even more difficult. I found the story of St. Augustine about the 4th century, one of the great foundational church fathers in all of Christian history. But he was a wicked, evil man. He engaged in the most vile kinds of sins imaginable. I mean, he pursued sin at every turn. But who was praying for him? Who do you think? Mom. Mom was praying for him. Year after year after year. And she was speaking to a priest, and the priest said this to her, "Go thy way, go thy way, and God help thee." Listen to what he said. "It is not possible that the child of these tears should perish." Isn't that great? He knew, here's this woman, a woman so committed to praying for Augustine, that surely he would find the Lord. Now God answered that prayer miraculously, right? Did he answer the prayer because mom prayed? Yes. Now, a lot of other things, clearly. It was the sovereign will of God and all the other things mixed up with it. He repented mightily, but it was in part due to the prayer of that mother. Raise and release. Raise and release. For moms, dads, it's hard enough for a dad, but for a mom, it's got to be 10 times as hard. Finally, it's good to remind you that her parental legacy was not perfect. Now, I've recounted the things. She was not jealous or contentious. She trusted the sovereignty of God. She prayed justice of God. She prayed according to the sovereignty of God. We have no really record of her sins or her wrongs, but I guarantee you she was not a perfect mother. So I didn't present Hannah up here this morning to make all the moms feel bad. That's not what I'm doing. Of course, she was not a perfect mom. There is no perfect mother, and there never will be a perfect mother. And we need to be reminded that her parental legacy was not perfect because she ended up having 5 other children. We know nothing about those children. You know what we do know? We know that Samuel had 2 sons, and his sons were wicked. So it kind of skipped a generation there, as sometimes happen. They grew into greedy, power-hungry, and rebellious men. So moms, we honor you not because you're perfect, not because you never make a mistake. We honor you because of your continual love and sacrifice. Some of you are familiar with Elisa Morgan. She was the president of MOPS International for about 20 years. I'm going to just share a little testimony from her. She begins by saying this: "I'm probably the least likely person to head up a mothering organization. I grew up in a broken home. My parents were divorced when I was 5. Some of you can relate to these things. My older sister, younger brother, and I were raised by my alcoholic mother. While my mother meant well, most of my memories are of my mothering her rather than her mothering me. Alcohol altered her love, turning into something that wasn't love. When I was asked to consider leading MOPS International, a vital ministry that nurtures mothers, I went straight to my knees and then straight to the therapist's office. How could God use me, who had never been mothered, to nurture other mothers? The answer came as I gazed into the eyes of other moms around me and saw their needs mirroring my own. God seemed to take my deficits and make them my offering. My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. I want to leave that with you, moms, that in your imperfect legacy that you're building this day, His grace is sufficient in your weakness, directly into your weakness, the weakness that plagues you, the weakness that you wish would go away forever. God's grace is sufficient in that one and all the rest as well.